free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Tuesday, May 27th, 2014. And we're talking about Theodore Roosevelt today, one of my favorite subjects. The evil Theodore Roosevelt. You know he's evil because all the bad guys love him. Bill Clinton said he is my favorite Republican president. Ooh. So we're going to talk about him with Joel McDermott, author of a new book, a small book, American Fascist, The Real Theodore Roosevelt. Before we get to that, I just want you guys to know, not that I'm looking for pity, but you know what? Maybe I am. Maybe I am, doggone it. We're getting ready to head out of town tomorrow. We're going to Boston for a week. I've got a college reunion there, and I figured I'd make a whole trip out of it. That's why I'm speaking in Boston on June 2nd at Cheers. You can get the details on that at tomwoods.com/events. And getting ready for a trip for a week with five kids, including a newborn, is an extremely taxing, time-consuming process. Meanwhile, I'm trying to prepare enough programs of the Tom Woods Show to run in my absence the whole time I'm gone. Then I'm also finishing up my Western Civilization course for the Ron Paul Homeschool Program, and I'm finishing up this week. So, and you can see all the topics of that course at tomwoods.com/westernciv. And I've got it scheduled so that pretty much just as we're getting in the car to head to the airport, I'll be all done with all these things. So, I mean, it's totally crazy. In fact, maybe I'm losing my mind right in the middle of this show. So I just wanted you to know I'm holding it all together, but barely. So I hope you enjoy the programs in the coming week while I'm gone, because I really worked to get them to you. All right, let's turn now to Joel McDermott. I got a little bit more banter for you after my conversation with Joel, so don't turn off your device. Stick around. Joel McDermott is the director of research for American Vision. AmericanVision.org is their website. He's the author, in addition to the book American Fascist, he's the author of How to Argue with a Liberal and Win, and Restoring America, One County at a Time. Joel McDermott, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom. It's my pleasure.
I'm pretty sure you titled this book, American Fascist, The Real Theodore Roosevelt, the way you did, because it is provocative, but at the same time, well, you are able to defend that statement. So go ahead and do that. First of all, let's talk about what fascism is. It's not just a general term of derision. It has a specific meaning.
Yeah, unfortunately, it has come up with kind of a watered-down colloquial meaning in our society, but no, historically, it refers to this kind of conglomerate between a strong centralized national government, which has tight controls over national industry, fully integrated with the military, and historically has had a strong national racial element with it, although I don't necessarily think that would be required.
No, I don't either.
Yeah. But the important part is the strong centralized government fully integrated into the national industry and military, and that usually leaves the illusion of private property. On paper, they talk about private property, individual rights and stuff, but in reality, it's the collective total government regulation and things of that nature. So that's the aspect that we focus on here. When we say American fascist, we have a guy at the turn of the century who was advocating things that would later be called fascism under Mussolini, under Adolf Hitler, their economic and social policies almost across the board in the person of Theodore Roosevelt. And so it's a perfectly justifiable claim, especially when you get down to the technical meaning of the word.
Well, the word also has other connotations. It also implies a system in which there is a charismatic leader at the head of the country who is thought to embody the spirit of the people. And so any sort of any institutional obstacle to the realization of his will is to be disparaged and eliminated because the people, in effect, their spirit speaks through him. Likewise, there is a special emphasis on the martial virtues, on war making, on the flabbiness of peace, in effect, as Roosevelt would put it, and the way that war helps to forge a people and to make them stronger. Now, these ideas, we see them reflected, obviously, in the fascist regimes of the 1930s, but as I'm describing them to you, they sound to me exactly like the views of Theodore Roosevelt.
Yes, absolutely, and it may shock some people to read some of the direct quotations in which he says these things. But you know, he had all the things you just described. Obviously, a charismatic figure, so much so that when he decided to split the Republican Party in 1912 and form his own Progressive Party, there were tens of thousands of people, not just following him, but at the National Convention. I mean, this guy, and worshiping him, literally almost worshiping him, using the guise of Christian language. And so you obviously had that aspect. But that goes all the way back to the beginning of his terms as president as well. He openly spoke of increasing the power of the executive to the point where he could do end runs around Congress if necessary. He would find powers in the Constitution, new powers in the Constitution that broadened the executive power. And of course, we talk about all these things in the book, all the power grabs that he did with land, the increasing the strength and size of the military, all of that kind of stuff. And he was openly boastful about it, which is kind of funny because he's always remembered as, you know, speak softly and carry a big stick. Well, he carried a big stick, but he didn't speak softly about it. He made sure everybody knew he had that big stick, and he liked to boast of the fact that he used it on occasion. So he had a big mouth to go with his big stick. And in doing so, he won the hearts and minds of the people, which is, you know, is another angle you could go at. But certainly, also, as you said, takes that spirit and that image of power, of projection of power, of the increase of power, and uses that as a means to develop the social ethic, if you will, of all of society, and kind of be the embodiment of the American spirit, if you will, such that people begin to think of manliness in terms of outward size and strength and power. And of course, you'll see this as we go through here a little bit, if we get to it, that worked out in his own life. I mean, always with the emphasis on war and strength and exertion, things of that nature, and totally neglecting the other sides of manliness, which are devotion to family and taking care of your family and things of that nature. And there was one anecdote in which he actually wrote that he had a sick child and sick wife. When the Spanish War began to ramp up, and he literally wrote and said, "I would have left her deathbed to go fight in that war." And so that, in this case particularly, that striving after that strong national spirit has other effects in what you neglect.
I hadn't known about that. I've written quite a bit about Theodore Roosevelt, but I had not known about that statement. That is so revealing. Just how warped his priorities are, that here he has a flesh and blood natural obligation to somebody in this world, and he'd rather go off and fight for an abstraction in a totally avoidable conflict. That speaks volumes about him. Now, of course, his whole personality was the personality of somebody who loves to be in the arena, as he put it, who loves to be involved in things, who wants to be in charge. Of course, one of his kids said that father wanted to be the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral. So this is the most dangerous kind of person of all to have in the presidential office, because he's got to have, temperamentally, he's got to have a hand in everything.
Yeah, this is a very interesting point. And it goes back, what makes it even worse in his case was he had a deep psychological need based in his childhood, deeply rooted in his childhood. And this, I think Thomas Evans talks about this in his book on the war lovers, and we're able to document it fairly well. His father was a wealthy industrialist, Roosevelt's father was, and he bought his way out of the Civil War, as many wealthy men did, by the way, especially from the North. Instead of going to submit to the draft to go fight, they would pay for a substitute or two to go fight for them. And this was such a sense of shame for Teddy Roosevelt that his father did not complete the rite of manhood of going to war and essentially bought his way out of it, that he spent his entire life, if you will, trying to atone for what he considered that shameful evasion. And so you see him as a child even playing war, as we're told in some places, that he would dress up in rags and pretend like he was in combat uniform, war-torn combat uniform, and, as a soldier. As he grew up, he couldn't wait to get involved in things like, in the military and things like that. By the time he's 30, we find him desperately trying to get into some position where he could affect national policy in that regard, and he does. By the time he's 31, I believe, he's the Assistant Secretary of the Navy. Well, he's not content to sit there and just do his duty. He wants to make the military bigger and stronger, and the means of doing that is by getting us involved in the war. So over and over again, he's constantly trying to get us involved in a war. At first, it was with Germany. He writes to one of his friends and says, I don't care if some of our seacoast cities get bombed and burned. It would be a good object lesson to us that we need to build our defenses up. He says it again after that war scare with Germany's gone. He does it with Britain. He says, I don't care if New York gets burned. It would be a good object lesson for us. He does this kind of stuff over and over. He's constantly agitating, trying to get us into a war. So then when you finally get to about 1896, we find him writing, and he's not content that he's only the Assistant Secretary of the Navy because he doesn't have that little bit of extra power to affect what he wants. And he writes to a friend and he says, I wish I just had the extra power for 2 days. 2 days is all I need. And then I would resign it, because by that time I would have things set on course that they couldn't be reversed, and we would be going to war. And of course, you know, he doesn't get that chance, but he does get the chance for war a couple years later. When the Spanish-American War takes off, he effectively resigns his spot in the bureaucracy and goes and starts the so-called Rough Riders Brigade. He couldn't wait to get involved with his own hands. And, I document, this is a long narrative in the book, that, he gets to Cuba. He uses all kinds of machinations, including disobeying orders and outright lies, in order to get on the ship there so he's sure that he gets to Cuba. He gets there. He does the famous charge up San Juan Hill. You know, that turns out victorious. He can't wait, though, just to win that battle. He wants to shed blood with his own hands. And so he chases these Cubans down the hill, catches them in as they shoot at him, but then they turn to retreat. As they turn to retreat, he shoots the guy in the side. And then he's not content that he's killed a man. He has to write home about it. So he writes his great friend, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, who's another great imperialistic statist, and brags to them he killed a man with his own hands. Finally, he achieved the goal of his life, to hunt, as he said, the most dangerous game, which, of course, is mankind. And so he writes this letter. And then he's not content with that. He thinks he deserves the Medal of Honor. And so he spends the next decade or more agitating with Congress and with the Pentagon to give him the Medal of Honor. Of course, they never do it. It gets awarded to him posthumously under Bill Clinton, which is a great irony in itself. But anyway, you've got this image of a guy who spends his entire life with a focus on getting involved in the war for the sole purpose of proving his manhood and building the nation's defenses, not necessarily any kind of a just cause, not a defensive cause, but solely out of these twisted psychological needs that he has. His entire life, childhood, adolescence, manhood, and even after that, he's wanting to be awarded the highest award possible for what he's done. So what I try to document here is a twisted personality who, as you said, got into the highest office of the land eventually. And that, even after he achieved all those things, the lust for war never abated, and even up until he was out of office in 1915, he's agitating, condemning Woodrow Wilson for not getting us into World War One, over and over until he's even trying at age 60 to go start his own private brigade of volunteers to go fight in France, and Wilson actually rebuffs him and wouldn't let him do it. die on the battlefield. So, again, twisted psychology, twisted personality, and very dangerous positions of power.
Joel, what would you say to a defender of TR who might say, yeah, for all his over-the-top bluster and his obvious enjoyment of combat, during his presidency, the U.S. really didn't get involved in that much in terms of military conflict. So he may have talked a lot and he may have enjoyed individually being involved in war, but he didn't carelessly thrust the country into war.
Well, I mean, maybe not as president into any major war, but any time he was even close and the issue was up, he was trying to get the nation into a war. So it wasn't bluster. It wasn't just a personal private thing. He was always trying to get the whole nation into a war so that he could be part of it.
Well, so yeah, for example, what do you think would have happened if he had been president during World War One?
Oh, I have no doubt he would have pushed us into it as early as possible. He was condemning, this ties into another chapter of the book, by the way. He was condemning Woodrow Wilson as early as 1912. Of course, they're campaigning against each other. But Wilson at that time was more of a Cleveland Democrat, more of a peace-loving, limited government guy who had some peculiar ideas on that, but he was not the big progressive we know him today. And Roosevelt was hammering him for this because he didn't believe in strong centralization, because he didn't believe in defending us at all costs and getting involved in the wars of intervention, being the world's police, as he would almost coin that type of foreign policy. He was condemning Wilson for these things. And so if he had won that election, I have no doubt we would not have waited until, you know, what was it, 1917 to get involved. We would have been involved much sooner. And even around 1915, you can see Roosevelt has no real power anymore. But he's writing books. He's publishing newspaper articles. He's publishing in German tabloids, which is very interesting anecdote in the book, trying to get America involved in the war, trying to condemn the president for keeping us out of it. So I have no doubt we would have been in it much earlier had he been president.
Now, what about TR, the trust buster? What's the truth about that?
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things. He's known as the trust buster. There's a couple points there. The first one is, relative to the other presidents around him, he wasn't much of a trust buster, especially if you compare him to his successor, Taft. Taft disbanded more trusts through the application of the Sherman Antitrust Act. He disbanded about twice as many as Roosevelt did in about half the time. So if anybody deserves the label trust buster, it's Taft and not Roosevelt. And, of course, that became a point of contention between the two. Roosevelt had supported Taft early in his presidency, but he turned against him when Taft applied the act against one of the Carnegie trusts, and that's the second point. Roosevelt did bust a few trusts, but almost with one exception. All the major trusts that he busted were all from the Rockefeller interests and not from the Morgan banking interests and Carnegie. And the reason for that is because those were the great political supporters of Theodore Roosevelt. So he used the act to go after his political enemies and other people, and he did not apply it evenly to the Morgan trusts. Well, when Taft gets in, he just goes a little more consistent. He starts applying it to some of the Morgan trusts also, and Teddy Roosevelt blows up at him, breaks friendship with him, and then never supports him again. And, of course, in the following election, he runs against him as a progressive. So, yeah, the trust busting, it's kind of a myth that itself needs to be busted.
But then beyond that, though, let's say that none of these political factors, let's leave those to the side, as interesting as that is, and just ask the question, didn't he, though, by busting those trusts, improve the condition of the consumer?
Well, no, absolutely not. And that really ties into a lot more of his legislation and his regulatory mentality, in addition to the trusts. What he actually did was he busted more of the smaller guys and regulated a lot more of the smaller guys out of competition, And that leaves a lot of the larger corporations, major corporations and financial interests in power because they can afford to deal with this stuff. They can afford to hire the lawyers to find the loopholes. They can hire the accountants to, shift money around however it needs to be to create the smoke and mirrors. And what happens is this type of regulation and this type of adjudication works inevitably to support the large trusts and to support the big corporations and to drive the smaller guys out. And so this works, obviously to hurt the little guy and the average guy, but it works also to help the state because here you've got the mechanism in place for that strong national centralization over industry that Roosevelt wanted. And, of course, this is how national corporatism still works today, if you will. National Chambers of Commerce and things like that. So, it doesn't help at all. It doesn't help the little guy. It doesn't help the consumer because by imposing all those types of regulation and whatnot, you add costs to the cost of doing business. And what does that do? That cost just gets passed on to the consumer. So, no, this hurts small businesses and it hurts consumers.
Well, and also we have empirical evidence that the targets of TR's activities were in fact lowering prices to consumers. So it's not a question of consumers are being fleeced and there's monopoly power being exerted. There's absolutely no evidence of that. It's just the opposite. You know, you mentioned Bill Clinton, which is quite interesting. Clinton said that TR was his favorite Republican president, which is really all you need to know. And yesterday when I was telling people about this program, I was saying we're going to be talking about Theodore Roosevelt, who is universally beloved as a great American hero, which is how you can be sure he was a villain. Yeah. Today they all love him. And I mean, I hate to ask you such a simple question, but what purpose is served by the apotheosis of Theodore Roosevelt?
Well, nothing but the increase in the size of the state. Period. Nothing but that. And with that, the subsequent reduction of individual freedom. And you see the same, I mean, look at Mount Rushmore. You've got TR right up there next to the right next to Lincoln. And Jefferson's on there too, right? You might be able to give him a pass on some things. But Washington, he's almost untouchable. But honestly, he belongs in the same group. And he is apotheosized, by the way, in the White House. Congress, the Congressional Building. What purpose is served by, deifying any of these guys with these policies of strong central national government? It can be nothing but the deification of their policy, which means the deification of the state. And when the state is deified, you're destroying all the foundations of freedom, all the foundations of freedom, which I believe ultimately are religious. But even if you don't look at it that way, to deify the state is to diminish any other possibility of foundations of freedom in society, which means there are no foundations of freedom left. So what purpose is served? The purpose of growing the state, period.
The book is American Fascist, The Real Theodore Roosevelt. How can people get a copy of this?
It's very easily obtainable from the website of my organization, AmericanVisions.org. You just go to the home page, and we've got a banner up right there that says American Fascist, bright red banner. You can click on it, and you can find the book very easily.
Okay, it's a short book. It's a quick read. The website is AmericanVision.org. The author is Joel McDermott. Joel, thanks for your time today. I hope we've given people a tantalizing enough sample of this that they'll rush out and read it for themselves. Thanks again.
Thanks, Tom. Bye-bye.
All right, everybody, that's Joel McDermott. Tomorrow, it's Lou Rockwell. I mean, it's almost like the shows are better when I'm not in town, right? So tomorrow, it's going to be Lou Rockwell. You're going to have a lot of fun with that episode. It's going to be a great conversation, so make sure you're listening in. And, of course, you want to be a subscriber, because you'd never forgive yourself if you missed that episode. So subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. We have new programs every weekday. Head over to TomWoodsRadio.com. That's my show site, TomWoodsRadio.com, and you'll see easy subscription links for iTunes and Stitcher. One more thing. Your host is running himself ragged. If you'd like to help, if you'd like to say, Tom, I appreciate this program. Thanks for all you do. There are two ways of doing that. Number one, you can become a supporting listener of the program and get transcripts of all the episodes, plus special discount codes just for you guys for a whole bunch of Liberty retailers, 60% off at myLibertyClassroom.com. For a mere five smackers a month, you can say, Tom, I appreciate the fact that you're doing this. So go over to SupportingListeners.com and warm my heart. Make me say, ah, people enjoy what it is that I'm doing. Secondly, at no cost to yourself, you can help us out here on the show. Every time you're about to make a purchase on Amazon, just remember that little voice in your head. You're not going crazy. That voice is my voice saying, hey, remember that show you love? At no cost to yourself, you can help us out. When you're about to buy something on Amazon, just head over to TomWoodsRadio.com first and enter Amazon from there. All right, Lou Rockwell tomorrow. It's going to be great. Tune in then. Thanks for listening.
The Tom Woods Show.